Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston and supported by the Humankind Program Fund.
It's a question of perspective and remembering what I really care about, which might be being kind and not being right, for example, in a certain situation.
So a willingness to swallow one's pride.
Yeah. Yeah, and to remember ups and downs are inevitable. They just happen. That's how things are.
Buddhist meditation teacher and author Sharon Salzberg describes a spiritual practice known as loving kindness. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. You kind of want to be on best behavior to meet someone who has written a popular book titled Loving Kindness, especially when the author is a longtime practitioner of peaceful meditation. But Sharon Salzberg, who divides her time between New York City and the central Massachusetts town of Barre, quickly put me at ease. And it wasn't just her relaxed manner and good humor, it was her whole philosophy of trying to treat others with compassion. I wondered how someone with that intention views the other person.
I think we're seeing that person as full of potential for change. Not to say that they're necessarily a nasty person and need to change according to our lights, but we see that there's a capacity within all of us, without exception, for movement, for growth, for transformation, for understanding, for love, for compassion. And even those times when we're very far away from that capacity, when we're not living it, I think the capacity is there. And so rather than seeing somebody as like all bad or all good or distant from us, having nothing to do with us and sort of in a box somewhere, we see this fabric of life, I think, really a sense of connection, not necessarily liking, but connection. And all in flow, all in movement.
All in flow and movement?
Yeah, I mean, I think in that sense that we're all composites of many facets. We're all full of desire, full of love, full of rage, full of fear. And certainly we don't act on every impulse that comes up in our minds. I think any one of us can look back at a time and say, well, it was because of my background, it was because of my education, it was because of my training, it was because of sheer good luck that I didn't act on that impulse, that I was about to do that terrible thing and the phone rang, and thank goodness it did. You know, so there's a certain sense that we have of really being connected. Not that we like everybody or approve of everybody, but it's knowing that our lives have something to do with one another.
I think most people want to treat others with basic decency and sensitivity, and yet it is so easy for us humans to slip up and behave coldly and sometimes hurtfully mm-hmm. toward others. So what happens there? What blocks us from attaining a higher level of behavior in our interactions with other people?
I think of it as almost like the creation of the other, not necessarily through anger or prejudice or bias, but just indifference. We come upon people who serve a function in our lives, like the checkout person at the supermarket or something like that, and we tend to look right through them rather than have a certain sensitivity, like, this is a person who wants to be happy just as I do, who's vulnerable to change, to loss, just as I am. But more commonly, they're a little bit of an extension of the cash register or something like that, or even an impediment to our getting home on time. So there isn't much training, and I think it actually is a training in empathy, in compassion, in just that recognition. And it wouldn't take much. It's like we have to pause. We have to pause and really look at that person. We have to think about them, not as an object, but as a person. And so, too, we can extend that to many, many people.
And it doesn't take a very long pause to notice that there's another living, breathing human being here.
It doesn't take a very long pause. Isn't that poignant?
Let's discuss the practice of loving-kindness meditation. What is that?
It actually is a form of meditation, of contemplation, where we concentrate on wishing ourselves well and wishing well to others, not for the sake of having a phony kind of weird feeling, like everything gets all sentimental and mushy, but to really stretch our attention. So going back to the example I was using before, if there are many beings like that checkout person at the supermarket we're used to looking right through or just counting, we actually take a moment to connect to them and we think something like, may you be happy, may you find peace. We use phrases like that, silent phrases like that, you know, kind of go around the street and the supermarket and all these places saying that out loud. We use silent phrases like that as a way of stretching our attention so that we can move out of the habitual rut.
So what happens to the person who has that kind, positive thought about the other when we introduce into our intentions, you know, may you be happy, may this be a good thing for you? What happens to the person who wishes that on the other?
One thing that happens is that we have much more of a sense of connection. We're not so afraid. We don't feel so alienated or estranged.
Not so intimidated by somebody who's a stranger.
Yeah, and we don't have, we actually notice somebody. It's like the phrases become the vehicle for our attention so that instead of just thinking, hurry up, would you, you know, I got to get somewhere. We have just a kind of consideration of that person and an appreciation, like, here's a life. I don't know their story. I don't know anything about them. I don't know their triumphs. I don't know their tribulations. But I can guess they want to be happy, just like I want to be happy, and that things probably aren't so easy the way they're not so easy for me, and that in some way we're in this together. We share this planet, and that I may not win by you losing. Actually, I can see the world in a very different way than that.
Sharon Salzberg was a bright high school student who attended the State University of New York at Buffalo at age 16. She says she was raised in a family with a lot of loss and pain. That inspired a thirst for spiritual answers that led her to study Asian philosophy in college. Salzberg became drawn to the Buddhist technique of meditation, which gives practitioners a new way of seeing the peaks and valleys of life. In 1975, she helped found the Insight Meditation Society. Today, Sharon Salzberg maintains a busy lecture schedule.
You know, I travel so much, and planes are late, and luggage gets lost, and it's quite fascinating to see how people treat the airline personnel and what comes up in my own mind when all of those things happen. And to realize that, by and large, this person is not out to get me, you know, they're not trying to harm me.
You mean the plane is not delayed as a personal vendetta against you.
That's right. Nor did somebody, you know, look at that luggage and think, let me send it to Omaha, you know. I mean, things happen. Conditions come together. And there's a very different quality of the relationship when you don't assume a hostility and an intent to get you.
So really, to make a conscious attempt to defuse the tension in a difficult situation.
Yeah, and you know, there's that little flip where we take a moment and see if we can see it from their point of view, which is always very interesting. What would it be like to have to stand here at midnight with all these angry people coming up one after another, demanding a hotel room?
So the practice of loving-kindness meditation, Could you briefly walk us through some of the stages of that?
Sure. Maybe you would take 20 minutes or 15 minutes if you only had 15 minutes. Sit down, close your eyes. This is just one variation of it. You could do it walking as well, walking down the streets of wherever. But let's say you're choosing to sit. You can close your eyes or not, and you begin quietly repeating certain phrases, which are extensions of care toward yourself. That's how we start. So common phrases would just be things like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. And you gather all of your attention behind one phrase at a time, not trying to force a certain emotion or feeling, just that gathering is what empowers the practice. And when your attention slips off, you gently let go, you bring it back. No recrimination, no judgment, no condemnation. It's what one meditation teacher once called exercising the letting go muscle. It's like we let go of the distraction, we let go of the anxiety, we let go of the stress, whatever it is, and we just come back to the phrase. And so that's the basic exercise. We begin with directing the phrases toward ourselves. Then maybe we think of a benefactor, someone who's helped us, someone we feel grateful for. And could be an adult, could be a child, could be a pet, somebody who lifts our spirits, that we feel joyous when we think of them, if you have someone like that in your life. If you don't despair. You can just continue on with yourself. And then maybe we move to a friend. Maybe it's a friend who's doing well. Maybe it's a friend who's in trouble, who's really hurting. So we just begin to expand this. We begin to expand this sense of offering. We end with the extension of loving kindness to all of life. It's like, may all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful.
Do you practice this?
I do.
What difference does it make for you?
It's made a tremendous difference in my life, actually. I think that the essential quality, the essential change has been from feeling more alone, feeling more frightened, feeling more uncertain, to genuinely having more of a sense of connection with others. It's like I remember what I really care about. I remember what makes me happy.
So what is the power of benign intentions like that when we're really emanating a good intention for others?
Well, there's a big power within ourselves in that we're not dominated by so many of the other things that might happen. You know, so often when we meet somebody, for example, it's really, we're so deep into self-preoccupation. We hardly even notice them. It's like, what do they think of me? Do they like me? How much do they like me? Do they like me more than they've ever liked anyone they've ever met before? Oh no, they hate me. You know, and so we don't even notice them.
It's like the joke, enough about me, what do you think of me?
That's right, exactly. And that really, when we look at our day, there's an awful lot of that. And it's not very fulfilling. That kind of self-preoccupation is not the same as loving ourselves or really caring about ourselves. It's just this endless pit, and so we're lost in it.
Endless pit?
Yeah, because when would there ever be enough acclaim or interest in us or conversation about us? It just doesn't end.
We're talking with Sharon Salzberg, the author of Loving Kindness and Real Happiness. For more information, check our website, humanmedia.org. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. The practice of loving kindness is tested when we encounter conflict with others. Some people try to avoid conflict by sweeping it under the rug. Others react with anger sooner or later. But what are constructive ways to approach conflict when viewed from a perspective of compassion?
I think that there are a lot of different elements to that. Sometimes it's quite compelling to look at the nature of our anger and actually just sit and feel anger, which is different than why we're angry and saying it's good or it's bad, but really looking at the nature of the emotion itself, because we may see an awful lot of sadness in there, frustration, disappointment, expectation. And I think that gives us a better sense of what we actually want.
So to really see what it is when I fall into a reflex of being angry at somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like what's actually cooking, you know, because I think it also gives us a means to have a much more comprehensive response to the situation. So we're not just coming from the most superficial level, which might be the anger. We're also acknowledging the sadness and the vulnerability and the frustration or the grief or the guilt or whatever else may be happening. And so it's not that we never respond and we never try to make our needs met or anything like that, but we can be coming from a different place that takes in all of that understanding. So that's just one thing. It's like an experiment almost. It is very much an experiment where you might hold that person in mind and, first of all, look for the good in them to see if there's anything positive or good you can reflect on. And this is important to understand. It doesn't mean that you get kind of stupid about things and you try to pretend there isn't conflict, there isn't difficulty, there isn't pain, there isn't something that needs to change. So it's not that at all. But if we obsess about everything that's wrong exclusively, we will feel greater and greater distance from that person and more alienation. Whereas if we can think of one good thing about them, even if it's very small, then there's much more of a sense, almost like we're standing side by side and we can directly and honestly look at what's difficult, but it's not this great gulf of estrangement. It's also more true, not always. Sometimes we honestly will not find anything good in somebody, but I find that it's more true. It's like when I went to Burma to practice loving kindness meditation intensively for the first time, which was 1985. My teacher, who was a Burmese monk, suggested that I think of people, even people I didn't like all that much, and try to see the good in them, some good. And I went back to my room and I began the reflection, and I thought of somebody whose behavior I found quite obnoxious. I believe quite reasonably so, because I think it was. And then I had a memory of having witnessed him doing something really quite beautiful and generous for someone else. And he did that in the best kind of way. So she didn't feel demeaned or pitied or anything like that. He just did this thing so graciously and so well. And that memory came to my mind. And my first thought was, I don't want to think about that. That complicates things. It was much easier when he was like all bad and difficult. And
put him in a box.
That's right. It put him in a box. But the truth was he was a little more mixed than I had been thinking in my ordinary day.
So how did that change your approach to this person?
I felt a kind of warmth and a caring that didn't take away my response to a lot of his action. But it was a little bit like having a family member that we really find difficult, but they're in the family. So there's not quite that same sense of, like, you know, like, as soon as I can get rid of you, the happier I'll be, because you're not going to get rid of them. They're just part of your world. They're part of your life.
One thing I notice is that many people seem to travel back and forth along a spectrum between isolation at one end and feeling connection at the other. So when people are feeling isolated, emotionally, physically, spiritually, what are ways they can move to a greater level of true connection?
I'd say one way, of course, is to try to help someone else. which connects us to our own sense of inner abundance. It's like we so often think we have nothing to give, we have nothing to contribute, what we do couldn't possibly matter. But if we do even some small act toward the good, we help someone, you know, I have friends who volunteer cutting sandwiches and homeless shelters or things like that. And it's helped lift them out of some pretty severe depressions. And
kind of gets them out of themselves.
Yeah. And because we genuinely can make a difference, even if it's in like small ways. And it connects us to something inside of ourselves. It's like our shared humanity. And then we realize I do have something to give. It's not all so bleak.
Can you talk about the problem of people feeling alienated from themselves? How does that happen?
Oh, I think it can happen very easily. I think that we live in a kind of disconnect. We don't necessarily know what we're feeling as we're feeling it. And I often use the example of how important it is to learn that quality of mindfulness and connection, because it's not infrequent that someone will start to feel angry or annoyed and not even quite realize it, go off to the computer, type out the email, press send, and then 2 hours later they go, whoops, I guess I said that with a certain amount of hostility. I guess I may not get what I want after all. And, you know, so it's not a small thing to know what you're feeling as you're feeling it, not 2 hours later.
So pay close attention when you're going through an intense emotion as to what's really going on, and mm-hmm. be calm enough to notice that.
Right, and that's really what meditation training is. It's like we take those 15 or 20 minutes a day and practice that, because then we can do it in our life. You know, it's not just to have a good 20 minutes and then forget about it. It's really because of what can happen in the rest of our lives from that kind of training.
Sharon Salzberg sees her Buddhist practice as a work in progress, what she calls uncovering layers, a process that has yielded her concrete benefits.
Well, when I first began teaching, I was quite terrified of public speaking, for example. And of course, it's ironic because it is that kind of role. And I just couldn't imagine myself giving a lecture, giving a discourse. I could work with people one-on-one. And now I think nothing of it. And partly that, and several people actually, friends of mine who are poets or musicians, say they do loving kindness practice as a kind of antidote to stage fright. That if you're standing up on the stage and you're looking at all these people thinking, they're out to judge me, that's really scary. But if you're offering them loving kindness, there's much more of a sense of like, okay, we're here together, just us folks. And it's a very different thing. And I've done that in my own life, and I've extended it to all kinds of different relationships and encounters, and I think also I've been able to hone a sense of, it's almost like don't sweat the small stuff. I have a kind of saying that I use, like when I'm traveling so much, and if my mind starts going into one of those spins of like, uh-oh, this plane's going to be late, that means I'm going to miss my connection most likely. And then I'm going to end up in Portland, Oregon. It's going to be after midnight. There's not going to be any cabs. This is a real New Yorker, right? There's not going to be any cabs. What am I going to do? It's going to be like 1 o'clock in the morning in the Portland, Oregon airport. And I say to myself, something will happen. Like something will happen. You know, so it's interesting to watch those spirals without being so lost in them. And then just to realize, I don't want to go there. I don't need to go there. It'll be okay. I'm not going to perish in the Portland airport. A friend of mine actually heard me use that example in teaching, and he sent me an email not too long ago saying, just landed in Portland, lots of cabs.
I wanted to quote a very poignant passage from your book, Loving Kindness. You write, pain and pleasure are constantly coming and going, and yet we can be happy. When we allow for the mystery, sometimes we discover that right in the heart of a very difficult time, right in the midst of a painful situation, there is freedom. Can you explain that?
Well, one example on one level, just on one level, would be sometimes we're in the midst of a very difficult situation and there's a lot of love coming our way. People are reaching out, helping hands, and we don't see it. Or we think we don't deserve it, and we don't easily open to it. But what if we could? And not so much have this sense of being so alone in this battle, but more having a sense of being cared for, and therefore finding that intrinsic part of ourselves that is worthy of being cared for. So right in the midst of that miserable situation, that terrible situation, something else is developing. Maybe something we wouldn't allow to develop when we were sitting on top of the world and things were going great for us. So there's just potential, I think, in every situation.
And that gives freedom?
Oh, yeah, because I think, you know, if you wake up in the morning and you're dreading anything changing as though you could stop it, you're not very free. If you're consumed with interest in what you don't have rather than appreciating what you do have, you're not very free. If you, just as a matter of course, think everyone's out to get you and that you better be tough and you better be armored and you better not let them get too close, you'll never be free. And these are all just habits of mind that...
Habits of mind.
They're habits of mind that have been cultivated or have grown within us, and we have the possibility of seeing them and turning them around, in which case we can be free, even though we can't control the flow of circumstance. We'll still go up and down, and great things will happen, and terrible things will happen, and that's life.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
We've been talking with Sharon Salzberg. She's a longtime meditation teacher, co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society, headquartered in Barre, Massachusetts. She's the author of Loving Kindness, Faith, and recently, Real Happiness. Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliart. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal and Kathy Graham. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Tony Buck. Our program is produced by Human Media in association with WGBH Boston. Program development provided by Chart Media.
You can hear more episodes of our series at humankindpodcast.org. That's humankindpodcast.org.
This segment on Loving Kindness with Sharon Salzberg is Humankind Program number 158. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review at Apple Podcasts or another podcast service. It goes a long way in helping people find the Humankind series. And you can follow us on Instagram or Facebook, or check out our YouTube channel for full episodes of the podcast. Again, the title is Humankind on Public Radio. Finally, if you'd like to support this podcast, please go to humankindpodcast.org and choose how you can help at the top of our homepage. That's humankindpodcast.org. Thanks.